Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. On May 25th, 2020, the world watched as George Floyd was murdered by Derek Chauvin, a white police officer in Minneapolis, Minnesota. George Floyd was just 46 years old. In the weeks and months after his death, millions of people across the country watched that horrific video and took to the streets of large and small towns to express their outrage over the killing of Black lives and to demand major changes to the criminal system. After George Floyd's murder, Toulouse Olurunipa, White House bureau chief for The Washington Post, and Robert Samuels, national enterprise reporter for The Washington Post, were reluctant to cover another Black man killed by police. They wrote about Trayvon Martin and Michael Brown. They knew how this went. Reporters would sweep in, interview people, and then leave. But The Washington Post decided to go deeper. The result was a six-part series that took a deep dive into George Floyd's life and systemic racism. Once Toulouse Olurunipa and Robert Samuels completed that series, they realized that readers wanted more. They wanted to understand where we had come from in this country. They wanted to know why George Floyd's death sparked such a massive movement for change. So that series inspired them to do more reporting on George Floyd's life. They met with all six of George Floyd's siblings. They walked the streets where he walked. They went to rehab centers where he tried to put his life together. They met eyewitnesses who watched him die. And they went back seven generations to look through his family history. The result is a book called His Name is George Floyd, One Man's Life and the Struggle for Racial Justice. It won the 2023 Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction. So where are we 5 years later? How are you reflecting? What do you remember after George Floyd was murdered? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Robert Samuels is a national enterprise reporter for The Washington Post and co-author of His Name is George Floyd, One Man's Life and the Struggle for Racial Justice. Hi, Robert. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate the time.
Well, we appreciate you and your incredible work on this book and all of the reporting that you've done. You covered Newtown, Ferguson, Dallas, Baltimore, so many critical events. You know, Robert, when you sit back 5 years later and think about what you've learned about George Floyd, what we saw after his murder, and then, of course, the intense backlash to the uprising, how are you reflecting?
I think of two things. The first thing that I think of are the people who shared their stories with us in remembering their friend, their boyfriend, their brother in George Floyd, and how hard it must be for them to live in a country that seems to have walked away from so many of the things that they had promised in their brother's name. And I think of how persistent they've been over the course of 5 years. It's a remarkably American story, and George Floyd had a remarkable American life. The other thing that I think about, right, is the promise and peril of how we live as Americans. Now, a lot of people, I think, look back and wonder if what we felt or what we saw or what we believed was real or naive in 2020. And I would say that the reporting showed us that there was something unique and distinct happening in the middle of the coronavirus pandemic that allowed us to see that if Americans could fix itself and concentrate on the cruels of systemic racism, it would know it was wrong. And 5 years later, what we know is that when the work gets tough and things become more complicated, the path to creating a more equitable America becomes much harder.
You know, Robert, I was thinking about the coverage that we did, and we had so many incredible people on the show after George Floyd was murdered. But even before then, we did so many shows about the fight for racial justice and criminal justice reform. And one thing I remember, and I'll never forget this, we had a lot of older Black activists on the show. And so many of them said they never thought that they would see so many white people take to the streets after George Floyd's murder. And they said they just sat back and they watched it, and they were floored on so many levels. And I remember I had to actually look up the cities in California that I'd never heard of before. Like, where's that? I've never heard of that city. And there was a protest there. I think that's what really, I was just thinking this morning, putting the show together and over the course of the last couple of weeks, that so many older Black people were just watching this. And then the fact that so many protests took place in towns many of us have never heard of. It really is incredible to just think back and to remember that time.
Right. I mean, we saw what was literally the largest protest movement and the most sustained protest movement in the history of the United States, and not just places in California. There are some, we saw protests in all 50 states in various places across the world. I remember when we were doing the reporting, you know, I had to learn how to pronounce Taver, Montana, you know, a place I had never heard of before. But they were thinking about this. And also the extension of it, you saw in New Zealand and in Australia, sort of the comparisons between what happened to George Floyd, the larger idea of what happened to Black Americans in this country compared to Indigenous and Aboriginal populations there. You saw George Floyd's face emerge in Palestine, in the West Bank. You saw the comparisons in places like Kenya and South Africa. There was a true global movement, right? And I think the cynic might say, well, people just wanted to get outside, and maybe that's a part of it, right? But I think it's really important that we forget that it wasn't just people going outside, right? It was corporations saying they were going to do better. They were going to think about diversity and equity. It was government saying they were going to do better and thinking about these things. You know, you had people like from Senator Lindsey Graham to Mitt Romney saying that we need to do something about police reform, because even when I go to my community or I talk to my friends who go to different churches, they tell a different story about the police. All of those things were so real. And, you know, there was another thing that really struck me, and I think it speaks about the moment that we're living in today. So, you know, I live in Washington, D.C., and my dentist passes 16th and K Street right outside the White House. But that was known as Black Lives Matter Plaza. There were big, bold yellow letters that said Black Lives Matter there. And those letters are not there. And it wasn't until I was walking to my dentist that I remembered that those letters were originally put there after the President of the United States allowed agents and law enforcement to spray chemical irritants at peaceful protesters who were protesting before a curfew, right? And I think it's really important to remember that there was an almost immediate effort to clamp down on some of the momentum that was happening with some of these protests, as well as the fact that even after the President of the United States allowed the gassing of his people, people continued to march and people continued to move for the cause. That was the righteousness of the protests of the at the time.
Robert, how do you think we should be talking about this? Because it's so important to remember the movement that, like, as you say, the global movement that rose up, but then such an incredible backlash. And it's so easy to focus on that part of it, the backlash. I was just reading stories about the Trump administration, you know, ending diversity, equity, and inclusion, pressuring private industry to do the same. It's easy to focus on that aspect and forget the massive uprising. They're both important, but how do you think we should be talking about this 5 years, 5 years later?
Right. I think about this in a few ways. The first way is, you know, you have to sort of state what it is, right? We're seeing corporations pull back their commitments to creating a more equitable workforce and a more equitable world. A lot of them responding to pressure from the current administration that decided to ban DEI. The Supreme Court takes away affirmative action programs. The bill, the police reform bill that once had bipartisan support, fails in Congress. And culturally, right, you see the books that we were all flocking to read in 2020, and, you know, honestly, even the one that Tolu and I wrote, getting caught in the crosshairs of these efforts to stymie books that people would think harp too much on issues of race and racism. That's the world we're living in. And when we were ending our reporting, our initial reporting, it started to become clear that things were beginning to move in the direction that way. And I began to ask people, you know, what they thought the takeaway was. I mean, I'm a journalist and their opinion is as valuable or more important than mine. And I remember having a conversation with Jesse Jackson and I asked him, well, how do you keep hope alive? Like, what do you do? And what he reminded me was that he was the same age as Emmett Till, you know, who was brutally lynched in Mississippi at 14 years old. And at that moment, when the world responded to Emmett Till's lynching, Jesse Jackson thought it was done, that the world would finally unite around rejecting racism. Yeah. That didn't happen, but he didn't see that momentum again until George Floyd. Wow. And he said to me, you know, you have to remember that we're still winning this because you, from the grand perspective, if you look at where the country started in its stratified, heinous practice of chattel slavery, you see the progress when you look at it from a larger perspective, even though it doesn't look like it then. I was then reminded that it had taken 9 years between the day that Rosa Parks refused to give up her seats and the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. 9 years, you know, this has been five. And I think that instructs me to think that it's wrong to think that this moment is over, that the fight's not enduring, that the chance for America to be a better version of itself is still there. The other thing that I would share is that I speak to people who have taken up the cause of George Floyd's legacy all the time, and I ask them these questions. And what becomes clear to me every time is those who are closest to the pain are the ones who truly believe we cannot give up trying to create a fairer society. And I always say what reporting taught me was that pessimism is that our ultimate American privilege. Pessimism is our ultimate American privilege, in that those who have the ability to walk away are the only ones who ever think they can walk away. And so when we feel defeated, that's actually a part of our American privilege speaking, because we know we might be okay if nothing else changes.
Today, we're spending the hour with Robert Samuels, National Enterprise reporter for The Washington Post and co-author of His Name is George Floyd, One Man's Life and the Struggle for Racial Justice. This book won the 2023 Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction. If you'd like to join us, how are you reflecting 5 years after the world watched as George Floyd was murdered by Derek Chauvin, a white police officer in Minneapolis, Minnesota? George Floyd was only 46 years old. You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. What are your thoughts on the uprising that we saw in this country and around the world and the intense backlash that happened? You can also email your call at kalw.org. We have an email from a listener who says, I will never forget watching that horrific video. Can you talk about the significance of that video? This listener writes, I wonder what would have happened if that video did not exist.
Well, we know what would have happened. And we know that because the original report from the Minneapolis Police Department said that there was an incident that happened at 38th in Chicago in Minneapolis, and that the victim died through causes of his own self. No mention of what happened with a $20 bill, no mention of the fact that a knee had been placed on George Floyd's neck. And so what the risk was that people would have seen the police report, and what happened to George Floyd could have easily become the mythology or the legend of a neighborhood. Had it not been for the cognizance of 16-year-old Darnella Frazier to not just notice what was going on, but to record it and be so incensed to post it on Facebook, there's a good chance that this could have been easily swept under the rug. And we also know that because what our reporting showed was that before police cameras and before the Black Lives Matter movement, there were several instances in Minneapolis and specifically and Minnesota in general where something similar to George Floyd happened to someone else. We found 8 instances of Derek Chauvin using what is called a neck restraint, you know, choking, using that restraint against other people. So that was really important that that video existed.
You found 8 other instances?
8 others, yeah. So what the reporting showed us, we did an entire chapter looking at the history of the use of neck restraints in the Minneapolis Police Department. And I think it's important to note, you know, there's a kind of conservative movement that says Derek Chauvin was using a move that was authorized by his superiors. And in a sense, like in a kind of diluted sense without any context, they're right, that the use of the neck restraint was allowed to prevent the use of fatal force. And it was supposed to be stopped it was supposed to be stopped when the subject stopped resisting. So if someone's unruly, you could use it. And then when they calm down, you're supposed to lay them on their side and get off of them. What our reporting showed was that Derek Chauvin took the training. He began using their restraint a couple days after he first took the training. And there were at least 8 times in which he used it. And over time, he became more brazen in his use, which meant that for a person like George Floyd, who is much bigger than Officer Chauvin. Derek Chauvin was, I think, 5'9 and 143 pounds. George Floyd, 6'6, 225 pounds. His common explanation would be he needed it because the person that he was using against was a bigger person. But over time, we saw him using it longer and longer. And in the case of George Floyd's murder, he did not check for a pulse until someone asked him to check for a pulse. He did not release the hold when George Floyd stopped resisting. And so the video initially showed us that. But what the later reporting showed, when you look at things from different angles, when you have the testimony of eyewitnesses, it shows something that's a little bit more brutal than even what we all saw on Darnella Frazier's video.
Oh, that's devastating. I had not heard this before, that he did this 7 times. And I'm just reading from Axios right now. Prominent supporters of Donald Trump, led by podcaster Ben Shapiro, are fueling a major push to pardon Derek Chauvin.
President Trump has said he knows nothing about it. It's unclear what he's going to do. And as I noted before, this mythology that is perpetuated by Ben Shapiro and others on the right, also supported by Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, it's predicated on a few things that are not true and a sort of mistaken police reports. The first one being what we just discussed, that Derek Chauvin used a technique that was authorized by the police department. We just went over why the way he used it was not authorized by the police department. The second kind of tentpole of this theory is that George Floyd said he could not breathe even before he left the car. And that's true. George Floyd, when he was confronted by the police officer, he said, "I can't breathe." We also know from the reporting that we did, and all of this is in greater detail in the book, that George Floyd had a history of claustrophobia and cramped spaces. And so when he said he couldn't breathe, that was not necessarily in response to something done to him physically, but his anxiety about what would happen if he was in a cramped police car and returned to a cramped prison cell. The other thing that comes up a lot is this idea that George Floyd died of a drug overdose, and that was the overwhelming reason he died, not because of a knee being on his neck for 9 minutes and 29 seconds. Now, I think when you put it that way, it strains credulity on its face, but I think it's important to say that reporting doesn't shy away from the fact that George Floyd had fentanyl in his system that day. We were with eyewitnesses who are we reported with people who had seen him, who had been with him that day, who told their testimony of him not having an unusual amount of drugs in his system for a man his size. But also this idea that there was a deadly amount is patently false. There's no scientific reason to believe that. And while it is hard to see evidence of like a crush or strangling, that's a thing that's said in the preliminary autopsy. It's important to note, if you're thinking that way, that one, there was a second autopsy done that had deeper cuts that showed crush in George Floyd's trachea, but also that it is very common for people who are strangled to have no signs of strangulation. So the arguments that predicate this movement are very false.
Robert, is it safe to assume that we would not be talking about most of this, we would not be knowing most of this if it hadn't been for that video?
I think so. I think so. I think the path would have been a lot harder to understand. And, people who knew George Floyd had a religiosity about him, and he believed everyone had angels watching him. And he talked about that a lot. And people who knew him would say, If that were the case, George Floyd had angels around him that day. Because not only was there a were there people who were brave enough to show a video, who else was there? There was a man who used to fight in the MMA who noticed what Derek Chauvin was doing and correctly noted and said to him, "This is a chokehold. You're going to kill him. Get off him." There was also an EMT there who was off duty and was just had just gone about what our reporting shows in our book is she just went to get an ice cream cone and to get out of her house. She saw the commotion and demanded a pulse and told them she needed to get off him. You know, there was the testimony of a 9-year-old girl who was traumatized because of what she saw. And because of their testimony, right, because they could narrate what was going on, it added further clarity to what we saw on the video. The truth of the matter is also is that, you know, we try not to specifically focus on the murder itself, but about the conditions, about what it means to be Black in America and what it means to live in communities with a number of Black people. And what's also true is that on that corner that day, if you were in front of what was happening, what you saw was heinous. But if you are around the corner and didn't see, nothing sounded that unusual to you, right? And I think it's important for us to remember that, right? That policing in this country can be so routinely brutal that if you did not see it, if you just heard it, it wouldn't strike you as unusual. And that, I think, tells a larger tale about what it means to be in one of these communities in the United States.
And tragically, last year, the police killed at least 1,226 people, an 18% increase over 2019, the year before George Floyd was killed, according to an analysis by the New York Times, drawing on data compiled by the Washington Post and the nonprofit Mapping Police Violence. I also just want to mention, before we go to break, you mentioned Darnella Frazier, who was a 17-year-old heading to a corner market on May 25th, 2020. She came upon the scene of George Floyd dying under the knee of Derek Chauvin, and she recorded the killing on her cell phone and shared it with the world, which changed everything. That's why we're having this conversation. The Minnesota Star Tribune has a piece about her just a couple of days ago. She doesn't really speak publicly, according to this piece, but on Instagram, she called that day a traumatic experience in my life. She said, quote, "I sometimes catch myself feeling guilty for trying to forget and block it all out because it's such a traumatic experience. But truthfully, I could never forget about you. Your name still echoes and I will never be silent." That is Darnella Frazier, who was 17 when she came upon the scene of George Floyd dying on May 25th, 2020. On today's Your Call, we're spending the hour with Robert Samuels, National Enterprise reporter for the Washington Post and co-author of the book, His Name is George Floyd, One Man's Life and the Struggle for Racial Justice. It won the 2023 Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction. And after a break, we will talk more about George Floyd's life. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are talking about reflections 5 years after the world watched as George Floyd was murdered by Derek Chauvin, a white police officer in Minneapolis, Minnesota, on May 25th, 2020. George Floyd was just 46. If you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. What are your thoughts on the uprising that happened after the murder of George Floyd and so many other Black men and women? And then what about the backlash? How are you reflecting? You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we're joined by Robert Samuels, National Enterprise reporter for The Washington Post and co-author of His Name is George Floyd, One Man's Life and the Struggle for Racial Justice. He won the 2023 Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction. And over the course of many months, Robert Samuels and Toulouse Olorunipa did a lot of reporting, deep, deep reporting on George Floyd's life. They met with his siblings. They walked the streets where he walked. They went to rehab centers where he tried to put his life together. They met eyewitnesses who watched him die. They went back seven generations to look through his family history. Robert, this piece of the story often gets missed. And looking over the pieces about the five-year anniversary, so many of these pieces are about the backlash, which is so important. But in so many of these cases, we just forget about who these people were. Their families are still living through this trauma. So let's talk a little bit about this, because you both, you and Tolu, did so much important reporting on George Floyd and who he was and his family. So if we can spend a little bit of time on this, because it's so important. So as you report, his family was from North Carolina, and they ended up in Houston, Texas. His mom was a sharecropper, and she moved, like so many people do, because she wanted a better life. Can you tell us more about this?
Sure. As you said, we went back seven generations to really understand why George Floyd came into the world and why he came into the world poor. And our reporting discovered things that were really fascinating to Tolu and me. The first has to do with George Floyd's, the first person we found who was emancipated in George Floyd's family line, a man named Hillary Thomas Stewart, who was his great, great grandfather, if not two greats, then three greats. And Hillary Thomas Stewart was a pretty industrious guy. He had 22 kids, and he was able to amass 500 acres of land in North Carolina, which would have made him one of the wealthiest Black people in the entire state. But before he could make an intergenerational transfer, which is the way we transport wealth in this country, all of that money's taken away from him, all that land's taken away from him through fraudulent tax deals, papers he was forced to sign that he did not understand. We know he could not understand them because he was not allowed to know how to read. And he dies a pauper, and his family ends up trying to work on that same land under the auspice of a new person and cannot get out of the cruel, brutal vestiges of sharecropping. They're continuously lied and cheated. And it's kind of passed on in George Floyd's family that, you know, you should try hard, but you shouldn't reach too high, because if you do, a white person's going to take it. George Floyd's mother, Larsinia, moves to Houston, Texas, in order to get a new life and to try city living. And then the family endures the cruelties of redlining, poor schools, poor healthcare centers, all of which work against George Floyd. George Floyd, however, did not believe that he should have stayed contained in poverty. In fact, what our reporting showed was that from a young age, he told people he didn't want to rule the world. He didn't want to change the world, but he wanted to touch the world. And what that meant to him at first was becoming a Supreme Court justice. You know, in second grade, he was reading and writing at grade level. And his second grade teacher gives an assignment about what you want to be when you grow up. And he says he wants to be a Supreme Court justice because he had learned about Thurgood Marshall and he thought it would be the coolest thing to adjudicate the law. And even though he had shown signs of brilliance, people saw that he was fast and big, kind of lanky. And they said, people who succeed in our neighborhood, people who touch the world in our neighborhood, they don't become lawyers, they play football. And that's where he dedicated his life. Now, he couldn't meet the academic requirements to obtain a scholarship to play at the college level. which really set him on a terrible course, where he gives into the economics of the time, in the economics of the community. In this case, would be drug using and selling, and he gets arrested on a number of charges. Now, that's some of the biographical stuff, but for the people who knew George Floyd, they would say that he was a man of great ambition. He never wanted the conditions of his life to determine his impact on the world. He was funny, and he had a sheepishness about him. He was very uncomfortable with his size. He did not like getting hit. He did not like people thinking he was a mean-spirited person. And his family once told me that if there was a room of people who didn't know him, he'd make it a point to go and shake people's hand and look them in the eye so they know they shouldn't be intimidated by him. And he was also a pretty soulful, reflective guy. Some of the research that we did, we rummaged through old friends' closets and looked through old diary entries, and he wrote poems to himself about, the difficulties of his life. And all of those things really portended a sense of optimism, like things being terrible were never the end of the story for George Floyd. What all of those writings showed was, he'd say, things are bad now, but I am going to do something to change it. That was George Floyd's character.
Well, and to give a little more context, because you go into such detail, we learn that his mom, Larsenia, said that you can speak the ghetto language, but you also have to learn to speak the king's English. And she would give her kids impromptu spelling tests. And as you say, by the time George Floyd was in second grade, he was reading and writing at grade level, which is, it really is an amazing achievement for a family growing up in abject poverty.
Yeah, absolutely. Larsenia was known for her big, generous spirit in the Third Ward of Houston, where George Floyd grew up, which was a segregated neighborhood. And they lived in the CUNY Homes, a housing project, which was the most notorious segment of this segregated neighborhood. But she taught them that you have to respect the police, that people are looking out for you. She taught them the lesson so many black boys, myself included, had learned through life, that you cannot just do anything that you want to do. You have to be conscientious about it. And as George Floyd grew up, right, people were attracted to that sense of positivity. When churches were baptizing people on the basketball court. And if George Floyd was going to those church, he'd walk around and sort of get people to go to the church with him, when, and there's something that I think about a lot, right? George Floyd, he had sort of become a father figure to one of his nephews who was, his name is Brandon Williams. And Brandon was on a basketball team. He played basketball like his uncle. And the team was really good. And Brandon had a fast break and had a layup. And he misses the layup. And he thinks it's no big deal because the team was up by 50 points. And what the reporting tells us was that George Floyd, he was so upset that he would wake Brandon up every morning, and he'd have to do 50 layups in a row before he was able to do anything else and go to school, because he wanted to teach him that, you don't get many free passes in life. So when you get the free pass, you have to make the shot. You cannot take it easy. And I think that is really emblematic of his character.
We're speaking with Robert Samuels, National Enterprise reporter for the Washington Post and co-author of the book, His Name is George Floyd, One Man's Life and the Struggle for Racial Justice. Robert won the 2023 Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction with co-author Toulouse Olorunipa. Today, we're talking about the murder of George Floyd. It's been 5 years. Remember what happened after that, the massive uprising around the country and really around the world, and then the intense backlash we saw to demands for racial justice and major changes to the criminal justice system in this country. If you have any thoughts or reflections, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. I'll get to emails in a minute, but I also wanted to talk about the time that he left college was during the war on drugs. And you report that in Texas at that time, the number of white people arrested for drug-related crimes declined by 9%. And for black men, those numbers went up 360%.
It was one of the more fascinating things that we found. And I think, you know, there's this kind of sense that, oh, we kind of know this, right? But when you watch it happen and see the impact happen in a real person's life, it changes everything. Now, what the reporting showed was that growing up during that age in Texas meant, even though we know that blacks and whites use drugs and the same types of drugs at the same rates, that's what we saw. The number of white people who are incarcerated for drug-related arrests went down, and for black communities, it went up 300%. The second question then, right, Rose, is how did that happen, right? And that happens in over-policing of areas and an incentive to make quotas and sometimes make things up. Now, when we look at George Floyd's arrest records, we were able to document between arrest records and stories that were told from our families at least 20 times in which he was detained over the course of his 46 years. And they were often for not small things. In one instance we found in our book, he was detained for walking too slowly in his neighborhood, as if he had nothing to do. That's the reason he was detained. He was also detained one day for walking too quickly in his neighborhood, right? And eventually what that does is it creates conditions in which that if you are accused of something in a system that you know is unfair, you might plead guilty to a crime that you did not do, right? And in this case, George Floyd, you know, he did plead guilty to an armed robbery charge that to the end of his life, he swore that he did not do, and said he did it because he was offered a plea deal of 5 years as opposed to 40 years. Now, the reporting that we didn't just kind of take this police report at face value, like, I think Ben Shapiro and some others have done, Candace Owens has done. What we did was we actually went and found the victim and talked to her about her experience. And what she had told us was that she had told the police that the person who victimized her was 5'6". George Floyd is 6'6". And when they showed her a photograph of the person, of George Floyd, and asked, is this the person you did this? Who did this? You could choose positive, negative, tentative. She chose tentative, which would not meet the beyond a reasonable doubt standard that we have in our justice system. So what happens after you have a cruel system, a disproportionate system on the outset? But it's also important to note what happens when a person gets caught up in the system in Texas at that time, right? We can tell from the records that George Floyd had mentioned depression and feelings of anxiety and asked for treatment. He did not get that treatment, as far as we could tell from the records. We also know that when you're a convicted felon in Texas, one in three jobs that require, you cannot, excuse me, when you're a convicted felon in Texas, You cannot get a professional license for anything, right? And one in three jobs in Texas, our reporting shows, required a license. That means George Floyd, he could not do real estate. He couldn't even become a barber legally in Texas if he had wanted to. I think it's important to note when we talk about issues like this, right, that with the war on drugs from the federal government came a commitment to also invest in things like rehabilitation centers and boys and girls clubs in these communities that were being heavily policed. That was supposed to be the compromise. We will lock a lot of people up, but we will also give people opportunities so they don't resort to crime.
Well,
However,
we also learned, thanks to your reporting, that in Texas, when George Floyd was arrested on an assault charge, there were no public defenders, and the lawyer who defended him was appointed by a friend of the judge.
that's correct. That is correct. Yes. So all of this stuff is in our book, and the reason we did that was not just because we're nosy people, right? The reason we did that was because we really wanted people to understand that if you look at issues from face value, they do not tell you the whole story. And if we simply reduced this man to an image on a wall or a t-shirt, and then backed it up with some things we found on the internet, not only does it do injustice to the movement, to the people protesting in his name, but it really does an injustice to the person, right? And so when he goes, when we talk about the war on drugs, we talk about, you'll hear lawmakers, both Democrat and Republican, saying, yes, we put more police there, but we also put more programming in boys and girls clubs and rehab centers. But what the reporting showed, we said we could say that, but then we actually looked at the appropriations that came from the federal government. Those programs were zero funded. So even though they said they were going to send money to places like George Floyd's community, they never got there. So if you got caught up in the system as George Floyd did, it would take a really Herculean task to get you out of it because there were so little resources that were put in to help you.
Amazing. And also, just to think that you all went seven generations back. Think about all of the people who are benefiting from intergenerational wealth. Ancestors, many, many decades ago, had property, and it was given to that daughter and that son, and the people have money through their property. And how would George Floyd's life had changed if things had been different for the ancestor that you just told us about who had that property? And we have just a couple of minutes left. We're getting a lot of emails thanking you for your work. A lot of people said that they just didn't know this about George Floyd. And let's hear from one caller. We've got just a couple of minutes. Let's go to Howard in the Bayview. Hi, Howard.
Hello, Rose. I'm a white guy. I'm 72 years old, white guy. I've lived with privilege all my life. And when George Floyd was murdered, I was frustrated about thinking about what I could do. And it occurred to me, appropriate to what you just said, we not only inherit assets, we inherit debts. And in fact, there's a T.S. Eliot line, what we inherit from the fortunate, we have taken from the defeated. So I felt the need to go back through my family's history, and I ended up going back to 1629, when the first ones arrived in North America. And there hasn't been any slave owning, but there's been plenty of racism and genocide against indigenous people, massacres that my relatives took part in. And I've ended up writing it up for my family, and it's a book that I might even try to get published. It's all I could think to do was just try to acknowledge where we come from and let everybody in my family know, we owe something. So that's all. And I want to thank you and your guests for the work that you've done. I've always been concerned about racial justice and just always frustrated about what I could do.
Well, thank you so much, Howard. I wish we had more time. I'd love to find out more about what you uncovered and how your family responded. We'll do another show and maybe we can connect with you for that. Robert, I'm sure you've heard a lot of stories like this during the many talks that you've given. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, well, I'm floored by this story and so many stories like this. I think the fundamental truth of the American spirit is that we all really want what's best for our family and our neighbors. And I think the fundamental challenge is to really broaden our thinking to who's our family and who's our neighbor, right? I think of like all the things that I learned about George Floyd, but he always, there was a phrase in the CUNY homes that said, one roof, one family, because so many of the duplexes were connected and shared a roof, one family. And I think when you think about that, that means you can acknowledge some of the ills of the past, understand that that past doesn't fully shape you, even though it informs your thinking. And when you have that understanding, you can move towards something that's better than we have today.
Oh, beautifully said. Thank you so much. Robert Samuels is a National Enterprise reporter for The Washington Post and co-author of the incredible book, His Name is George Floyd, One Man's Life and the Struggle for Racial Justice. Robert and Toulouse Olorunipa won the 2023 Pulitzer Prize for General Nonfiction. Robert, thank you so much for your great work. Thanks for joining us. We'd love to have you back.
Thank you for the opportunity. Have a good afternoon, Russ.
Thank you. You too. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering today's show, and we hope you can join us tomorrow with Washington Post reporter Dana Hedgepeth. She'll discuss her reporting on Indian boarding schools. On Thursday, two Native American tribes filed a class action lawsuit against the U.S. government for its role in running a system that separated Native children from their families to eradicate their language and culture and force them to assimilate into white society. We hope you can join us tomorrow. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.